This podcast is brought to you by The Province.
You're listening to Keyboard Kimura, the official mixed martial arts podcast of The Province. Here are your hosts, Paul Chapman and E. Spencer Kite.
Welcome, everybody, to another edition of the Keyboard Kimura podcast here on Province Sports Radio. I am your host, E. Spencer Kite, joined again this week by my Punch Drunk Predictions companion, Patrick Svitlinski. Paul Chapman, as everybody knows, with all of the post-media job changes, let's call it that, with all of the chaos going on, Chappie's a little tied up, he's a little busy, so we tagged in Patrick again, seeming to be my regular co-host so far in 2016. How are things, Patty?
Oh, pretty good, can't complain, glad to be back, and ready to do the damn thing, let's go.
Ready to do the damn thing, still already up a couple of fights on me in the predictions, hopefully that changes this week. Take a look here in a couple of days, but this weekend we've got a UFC on Fox show, returning to Big Fox, as Dana White calls it, with what I think is the perfect fight card for this platform, headlined by a number one contender fight, or what we assume is a number one contender fight in the light heavyweight division between Anthony Rumble Johnson and Ryan Bader. Heavyweights Josh Barnett and Ben Rothwell in the co-main, and then a couple of prospects in Jimmy Rivera taking on Yuri Alcantara and Sage Northcutt taking on Brian Barberina as the other two fights on the main card. To me, this is the way these fight cards should be stacked up. You get to see a couple of up-and-coming guys in Rivera and Northcutt. You get a meaningful heavyweight fight. Everybody loves heavyweight fights. Everybody likes seeing the big boys get in there and chuck knuckles, try to put each other down. And then you get a really meaningful fight between two guys that most likely the winner is going to be fighting for a title. What do you think about this card before we get into specifics of each fight? What do you think about the way this card is designed and the type of cards that we're seeing on Fox these days?
Yeah, definitely harping off, what you were just saying there. I think it's the right way to go, sort of setting it up with a couple prospects. You get to see Sage Northcutt perform, which is always fun. He's showed out in the last few octagon outings that he's had, and I think his evolution is something that fans are definitely excited about, and he's just going to continue getting better, in my opinion. And I believe that people are excited to see him, and same goes for Jimmy Rivera for to a lesser extent. Not as many people know about him as mainstream fans, but he's a very exciting bantamweight, on the come up, and I think that it'll be exciting to see what he can do against a vet like Alcantara, The two fights, the main event and the co-main event, are pretty money to me. I mean, heavyweights are always fun to watch, like you said, and that main event is a true light heavyweight contender fight, in my opinion.
Yeah, so over the years, the UFC has sort of really played around with how they build these different Fox cards. We've seen some title fights. We've seen some contender fights. And to me, with the way they have worked at stacking some of these pay-per-views throughout last year, and as we see they're trying to do this year with UFC 197, which we'll get to a little later in the show, I think it's so much more valuable to them to be able to roll out cards like this on Fox, where it is main event, is a meaningful contender bout between some guys that people probably are familiar with. Ryan Bader, obviously coming off the Ultimate Fighter several years ago, been around for a long time, a very established guy. Rumble Johnson fought for the title a couple fights ago, been a main event or a main card staple since coming back. To me, this is the way that you build up some guys. I think, as you said, Sage Northcutt has showed out in his two previous UFC appearances. I've been there for both. He's a guy that is definitely generating some buzz and people are interested in seeing. And this, to me, just feels like the right platform for him for these fights. I know it's not necessarily sort of the big stakes feel of some of these massive pay-per-views. But if you get 2 million, 3 million people tuning in on Saturday to watch this main card. That's 3 million people watching a couple of up-and-comers that are going to be around and be players in their respective divisions for the next couple of years in Rivera and Sage Northcutt. And then a couple of fights where the winner could conceivably be fighting for a title. So to me, that's a win, and that's the right recipe for the UFC going forward.
Yeah, absolutely. I know. I agree with that fully. I think that, you know, when you set up these meaningful main events, you know, have them have some stakes. You know, you get Rumble Johnson back in there against, like you said, Bader. You know, two recognizable guys and two guys that a lot of fans, you know, enjoy for different reasons. And you know, I think it's a fight that will definitely lead to that light heavyweight title. And with the heavyweights, obviously, you know, we know what's going on with the UFC 196 situation. So this could be a much more meaningful fight in that sense as well with Josh Barnett and Ben Rothwell.
Oh, we will get to the UFC 196 situation here in our championship rounds, our next segment. Before we break it down, the other thing I wanted to say just about the composition of this is the other big takeaway for me is that you're then not in a position where the UFC is putting a championship fight in the main event and you get all these people that instantly make it about this guy or this girl can't draw on pay-per-view, so they're relegated to Fox, which always has felt like the wrong message for the MMA community to focus on. I mean, yes, Demetrius Johnson is not a pay-per-view draw, and there is some value to putting him on Fox, perhaps. But I think you're probably better off putting him as the co-main event, as we've seen the UFC do in the last couple of years with some of these lesser established titles, like the women's strawweight title, like Holly Holm and Misha Tate behind Conor McGregor and Rafael Dos Anjos coming up in a month's time. So it's nice to me to see it be about meaningful fights rather than automatically having that takeaway of, well, it's because this guy can't draw or this girl can't draw. So I think that's another positive for them with the way this fight card is built.
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's one of those situations where, you know, it's, you still get, you know, a great headlining fight on a big Fox card like this. I think the Johnson Bader fight is a really great fight, but, you know, like you were saying, I think with those, you know, champions who have that, you know, maybe sort of more difficult time getting that mainstream appeal, like a Demetrius Johnson, who obviously is an amazing fighter, but has had trouble, you know, gaining attention from, you know, the casual MMA fan. You know, I think that he is better suited in a position where he's a co-main event on a pay-per-view, which I think, you know, is a good idea by the UFC to sort of complement, you know, a great big, you know, main event like a Conor Dos Anjos, and then you get the Holm and Tate fight as well with that.
So let's get into this main card. We'll go from bottom to top, work from the opener to the finish. Starting with Sage Northcutt, shift an opponent a couple of weeks ago from Andrew Holbrook to Brian Barberina. The fight then gets bumped to welterweight. Sage Northcutt started his career at welterweight, moved to lightweight when he moved to the UFC. So it shouldn't be an issue in terms of going up in weight. It just means he doesn't have to cut as much the week of the fight. I think this is a really dangerous fight. We were in Montreal for Brian Barberina's last fight against Chad Laprise. Really looked good in a losing effort going toe-to-toe with Laprise in the Bell Center. I think this is the right kind of fight for Sage Northcutt at this point. You know, Andrew Holbrook would have been a reasonable challenge. I think he was a step up from Cody Pfister and definitely a step up from Francisco Trevino. But I think there's something about Bam Bam that really excites me about this fight beyond just getting a chance to see Sage Northcutt compete again. And I think this is where we kind of find out a little bit about what this kid's made of, what kind of heart and guts he has, because as we saw in Montreal, Bam Bam's not a guy that's going to go away easy.
Absolutely. No, I agree 100% with that. This is definitely, you know, Sage's biggest challenge of his UFC career, probably of his MMA career so far. You know, fighting Brian Barberina, you know, he's a guy who comes out of the MMA lab, you know, gritty kind of guy, loves to make the fight, you know, ugly and kind of, you know, get in your face. He doesn't mind doing that, as we saw with Chad Laprise. I think this is, like you said, it's a dangerous fight for him to take. You know, that being said, you know, Sage Northcutt is still a very, you know, amazing talent that is rare in the MMA world. So it'll be interesting to see what happens. I do think that, you know, Sage will have a more difficult time putting away a guy like Barbarina. You know, he hasn't, you know, been put away via knockout in his career, I believe, only been submitted. So, you know, he's gonna do all he can to make this an ugly, gritty fight. And, you know, Sage is going to have to deal with that. And against a guy who is in a weight class, you know, above the guys that he's fought in the UFC so far. And that does make a difference. I mean, no matter what you want to say about it, I think that plays a factor regardless, fighting a bigger guy like that.
E. Spencer Kite and Patrick Swiglinski on the Keyboard Kimura podcast here on Province Sports Radio, talking about this weekend's UFC on Fox event in Newark, New Jersey. I've seen Sage's first two fights in the UFC up close and personal. The kid gets a lot of heat on social media for being, as Ben Folks has called him on the co-main event part podcast, the most photographed barn in America. I understand where that comes from, but to me, that's all secondary stuff. I don't care that he's this humble, sweet, innocent-seeming kid that people want to take shots at, because I think it's stupid, honestly. I'm interested in Sage Northcutt as a fighter, as a guy that's on the come up, and I wanted to get your thoughts just of, like, how far do you think he can make it? On initial impressions, obviously, he's 19. He's had two fights. A lot of things can change. But first impressions, does he look like somebody to you that has the potential to develop into a contender a couple years down the road? Is he a Rory McDonald type, or is he a guy that maybe is making the most of things now and maybe doesn't quite get there 3, 4, 5 years from now?
You know, I think that he gets there. You know, just looking at his sort of performances that he's had, you know, you can tell this guy is a physical specimen. First of all, that's the thing. He looks like a friggin' action figure, you know, coming out of the gate. He's obviously very disciplined and well-conditioned. I think the biggest, you know, things that he'll have to work on sort of moving forward, and what I'd like to see would be just working on technique and tightening up his technique. What, you know, we saw in sort of the Pfister fight, he got a little wild, little reckless with his shots at some points in the fight. And, you know, when you go up in competition and continue fighting better guys, you know, there's guys who can take advantage of that that might not be as physically gifted as a Sage, but they'll go in there and capitalize because they know the technique and they can get there, you know, with a counter strike or something like that, you know. So I do think that Sage will definitely develop into a future contender just based on, you know, his commitment to the game. It seems that he's, you know, very committed and he puts in the work and the conditioning is there. I would just like to see him get with a good camp and, you know, just tighten up his technique. And I think that in a few years, we'll definitely see him in a title fight.
That was what I wanted to ask you. Obviously, we saw between his first and second fight, he went up and did basically a couple of days in Montreal at TriStar with Faraz Zahabi and the team up there, then booked that fight in Las Vegas, returned home to Katy, Texas, which is just outside of Houston, to prepare for that second fight. Do you think that is something he needs to do sort of long-term to maximize his potential, is get out of that comfort zone, get up to a TriStar, get to an American top team or an AKA, and work with elite fighters and elite coaches that have been there rather than just the guys that he's surrounded by now?
Absolutely. I mean, no knock on his dad at all. I mean, he's done a great job sort of, you know, helping him and getting him into martial arts. But, you know, you're only going to go so far being in that local sort of area. If he were to train at TriStar full time, I think that would just benefit him so much. Not only do you get to train under a guy like Faraz Zahabi, who has just so much, you know, knowledge of the game, you know, he knows the ins and outs, the intricacies of the fight game. You know, he is a,
is an absolute, you know, student of the game, and he understands things that other guys don't understand. You know, I think that it would just benefit him being there. Not only that, then you get to train with guys who will obviously make him better. You know, you have the Rory McDonalds, you have other guys in there who will just, you know, push him to a place that he probably wouldn't be pushed to if he wouldn't join a gym like TriStar. I think that that is a, you know, that would be a great move for him to consider going there full time. And I think it would only benefit him because he's already got the physical tools. He just needs to, you know, get that technique. And that is something that a guy like Faraz Zahabi can, you know, help you with very handily.
Yeah, I think the same thing. There's a world of potential there. It's scary how good, to me, it's scary how good he could potentially be if you put him in the right situation and the UFC continues to bring him along slowly and doesn't just decide, you know what, we need to huck this kid into the deep end and see what he's really about. Give him the time to build up and take these little incremental steps up in competition like we're seeing this weekend. So I think, as we said, this will be a fight where we get another chance to get a read on him, get a chance to see, you know, some more of the good, the bad, and maybe the areas that need some improvement. But definitely somebody that people should be keeping an eye on going forward, and I'm sure we will hear a lot about going forward as well. A guy that we haven't heard a lot about that I think is being slept on, that, as you said, sort of in just kind of as we were setting this all up, Jimmy Rivera, I mean, an East Coast staple. He auditioned for The Ultimate Fighter Season 14, handled Dennis Bermudez in the first round of that fight, then got tapped out in the second. It looked for a long time like those 7 minutes that he was in the octagon were going to be the only 7 minutes that he fought in the UFC, because despite a lengthy winning streak, he didn't get a call. Then last year, he gets sort of the short notice opportunity against Marcus Brimage in Scotland, goes out and wins that fight in under 2 minutes, gets a second victory against a tough prospect in Pedro Munhoz. And now here he is facing Yuri Alcantara, a 35-year-old vet in the top 15, a chance for Jimmy Rivera fighting relatively close to home in Newark, New Jersey, to really show out and make a statement on Fox.
Yeah, I think that this is a huge opportunity for Jimmy Rivera. You know, putting him so close to home, I think the UFC obviously knows what they're doing. And I think they know that they have, you know, a potentially special bantamweight in Rivera. You know, he has definitely looked, you know, very good in the UFC. I mean, you know, a split decision win over a very tough guy like Pedro Munhoz is nothing to be ashamed of. And the Marcus Brimage TKO that he had, you know, in his debut was pretty impressive as well. And he's been on a big run, you know, won a whole bunch of fights in a row. So I think that putting him, you know, in this spot closer to home against, you know, a vet like Alcantara is a big showcase fight for him. And I think that if he's able to, you know, get that victory, that'll put him into that sort of talk to, you know, potentially fight a top 15, top 10 kind of guy in that division, in the bantamweight division. And it's interesting how much that, you know, division has sort of developed. Now suddenly you have a lot of, you know, interesting fighters coming up with, obviously, you know, the title change and everything that's happened. And I think that Rivera is just a part of that next wave of bantamweights in the UFC.
Yeah, I was going to say, people that listen to this podcast, people that follow the blog, you and I have talked about it. Everybody knows that I'm a sucker for the lighter weight fighters. I'm always out here stumping for them. Bantamweight has been the division for me for the last probably year that I've just been the most excited about, because there is this wave of young talent coming up. As you said, we had the title change earlier in the month. Rob Font looked great on that on that fight card, coming back off a long layoff to get a finish. We've got Jimmy Rivera here. We've got Cody Garbrandt and John Lineker fighting in a couple of weeks. Then we've got the Thomas Almeidas. We've got Michael McDonald. We've got Aljamain Sterling, should he re-sign. It just feels like such an interesting division, because we have that great mix of young talent that is hungry and looking to get their moment to shine. And we still have veterans. We still have TJ Dillashaw. We still have, you know, Uriah Faber, and just tough dudes like Francisco Rivera and Brad Pickett, who will fight next month in London. So this fight to me is, as you said, a chance for Jimmy Rivera to shine, have that tough test that every young fighter on the come up needs to have, where you go in against the vet that's been there. And we've seen Alcantara derail some guys. We've seen some guys really take that next step. Frankie Saenz beat him to get that fight with Uriah Faber. And I feel this could be the same opportunity, as you said, for Jimmy Rivera.
Yeah, 100%. I think this is it's an important step for Rivera in his sort of climb up the bantamweight ranks. You know, it doesn't get easier now. It's only going to get harder. And if he can, you know, put together a statement victory over, you know, Alcantara, who is, you know, a seasoned vet, he's seen it all. I think that, you know, if he can come in there and really put on a statement performance, that puts him into that conversation of the top 10 in that division.
Co-main event of the evening, a heavyweight matchup that up until a couple of days ago, we weren't sure if it was going to be that way because of the changes that have taken place at UFC 196, which we'll get to shortly. But it is still here, Josh Barnett against Big Ben Rothwell. A great fight. I'm actually glad it's here. I think, again, this is the right platform for these guys. Barnett is an established name, looked really good against Roy Nelson last time out. Ben Rothwell, to me, I think we talked about it a couple of podcasts ago, is really sort of the unsung guy in the division right now, kind of the sleeper, despite the fact that he's coming off three straight victories, including a knockout finish of Alistair Overeem and a beautiful submission win over Matt Mitrione. I talked to him last week for a piece that'll be coming up on Keyboard Kimura later in this week. He has said that, and Jeremy Botter wrote a great piece about him on Bleacher Report today. Go check that out. He has talked about just really having a lot of pressure come off his shoulders, really finally feeling comfortable at age 34, 40 fights into his career, and that it has really showed in these last couple of fights. And this has just been a glimpse. He is a guy to me that, if you look at his record, that makes sense. He has struggled in those big step-up moments, in those big marquee fights where he can move to the next level. I really believe him when he says that that's a thing of the past. So I wouldn't be surprised if Ben Rothwell comes out here and just starches Josh Barnett.
Yeah, no, it's a very viable possibility. I think, you know, as far as that sort of, you know, big fight moment that came to, Rothwell in the form of the Overeem fight, where, you know, everybody was sort of thinking that, you know, it'd be a good fight for Overeem to sort of get back in there and put on a show. But obviously that didn't happen. And Big Ben ended Alistair Overeem's night, you know, in pretty devastating fashion, and then did a cool little dance to celebrate too. So, you know, I think that after that fight, you know, then we saw the submission of Matt Mitrione. He's just continued to sort of, you know, improve and look good. Even at 34, he looks the best he's looked in years, in my opinion. And I think that it's a very high possibility that he comes in there and he, you know, styles on Josh Barnett as well.
Well, and the crazy thing with this division, and we usually talk about sort of as guys get older, we start, you know, when are they going to hit that cliff? When are they going to start hitting the downside? The heavyweight division just doesn't seem to be like that. There's not a lot of young talent coming up. And one of the things Rothwell said when we spoke last week is just his opinion about it is that in this division where guys can get by early just on pure athleticism or power or just, you know, sheer physicality, it takes those number of years and those number of fights and it takes a lot of time to get in there and get that ring experience, to get some of the technique down, to be able to really develop your tools, because you do get by so many times with just being able to go in there and land those one hitter quitters and get guys out of there quick, because you are such big human beings. And I think that's really a factor which makes this fight, to me, even more compelling, because we know Josh Barnett has the whole repertoire. He's got everything down. Ben Rothwell, you know, talked about having some tools that people haven't seen yet. We've seen all of Josh Barnett's, and they are very, very good.
Yeah, no, 100%. And I agree that the sort of rules of, you know, a lot of these other divisions don't apply to the heavyweight division. You have to, you know, you can't look any, you don't have to look any further than, you know, Fabricio Werdum, the champion. He's 38 years old. So a lot of these guys, you know, they're hitting their stride sort of in their mid to late 30s in that division, and anyone can sort of be a contender, it seems, come up out of nowhere. So, you know, with Ben Rothwell, you know, having this sort of, I guess, mild resurgence, if you will, it's, you know, it's very exciting to see. And I think that, you know, he does have still some tools that maybe we haven't seen and maybe we will see against Barnett. But, you know, whether he does or he doesn't, the interesting part about this whole thing is that, you know, Ben Rothwell could be potentially fighting for a heavyweight title at some point in 2016 or at some point in early 2017 if he continues winning. And that's the beauty of the heavyweight division, is all these guys that are sort of in that division, it seems anybody can become a contender, you know, with a couple wins here and some impressive performances here, that, you know, anybody in that division can really come up and make a name for themselves, whether they're, you know, 22 or they're 35.
And I think the best thing about this fight is that regardless of how it plays out, regardless of who wins, we know we are going to get an epic, epic promo on the mic after the fight is done. It's going to be one that they won't have to bleep out like Nate Diaz a couple of weeks ago in Orlando, because these guys understand where they are, that they are on Fox. But both are very, I mean, Josh Barnett is a master at, you know, commanding the mic and talking about collecting the spoils of war. And Ben Rothwell gave us that crazy evil laugh against Matt Mitrione, so we should get something special on Saturday night for sure.
I hope so.
Main event of this card, light heavyweight matchup. We believe it to be a title eliminator between former title challenger Anthony Johnson and not yet a title challenger Ryan Bader. Honestly, I kind of feel bad for Bader at this point, because you look back at sort of how last year played out for him. He was set up to fight Daniel Cormier in New Orleans in June. That fight gets canceled as DC gets pulled to face Anthony Johnson for the vacant light heavyweight title. Then he goes out and he thinks, okay, well, DC won. I was lined up to fight him. I should be next in line for his first title defense. And the UFC says, no, that goes to Alex Gustafson, who got knocked out in January and looked brutal. And Ryan Bader has to fight, insult to injury, Ryan Bader has to fight Rashad Evans, who is coming off a 2-year layoff, on the same card. All just so happens that the day we go to media day is the day that John Jones' court appearance comes through and he gets cleared of everything and becomes that John Jones is most likely going to be reinstated. And so now here's Ryan Bader, even after going out and beating Rashad Evans, thinking, gotta be my turn. John Jones isn't back yet. And the UFC says, we'd like you to fight Anthony Johnson. Do you feel bad for him, or is this just, you know, the curse of the way these divisions work out with guys coming back and the UFC not necessarily being a meritocracy so much as a, this is the fight that people want to see?
I mean, you know, I got to feel a little bit bad for Bader. You know, he's definitely done everything right up to this point to sort of merit that title shot. You know, win after win, he's come out there and beat some pretty tough guys, you know, Vince St. Preux, then he beat Phil Davis, you know, and then he beat Rashad Evans. So I think he's done enough to sort of merit that title shot. Granted, you know, he's not, you know, blowing anyone out, knocking them out, you know, or submitting guys or anything like that. He's winning, you know, kind of grueling, you know, gritty decisions as Ryan Bader is wont to do. But putting him against Anthony Johnson is just so tough, I think, because, you know, it's a fight that I think, you know, stylistically is a pretty tough matchup for him. And being on that cusp of a title shot and having such a high risk opponent, that's got to sting a bit.
Yeah, I don't want to make it sound like Ryan Bader has no chance. Obviously, this is, one, it's the fight game. Anything can happen. Two, we have seen guys sort of get in there. You weather that opening storm from Anthony Johnson. His kryptonite throughout his career at times has been the wrestling game. A lot of people have said if Bader can weather that storm, maybe implement the same kind of game plan that Daniel Cormier did at UFC 187 in May. I'm not sure it's there. I think Bader has a chance to win this. I think he's being discounted and undersold a great deal. That being said, I still think Anthony Johnson is in that class just a little bit ahead of Ryan Bader. Still don't know where Alex Gustafsson fits in all of this because he looked so bad against Rumble in Sweden, but has looked so good in championship opportunities. Mind you, both losses to John Jones and Daniel Cormier. But I think this is one of those fights where we again sort of see that AJ's just a little bit better. And Bader to me, and people are going to think that this is a knock, but Bader to me is just the light heavyweight version of Michael Bisping, a guy that is going to beat everyone from 6 through the rest of the division down, but maybe isn't going to take that next step. To me, I would love to have that career. It is a lengthy career. You get 3 fights a year if you're healthy. You win probably 2 of them. You're always going to stick around and collect paychecks. I know everybody wants to be a champion, but some guys just don't have that opportunity. And unfortunately, I think that might be the case for Ryan Bader.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I agree with you about that comment. You know, he is, I think, good enough to beat, you know, most of the guys in that light heavyweight division. But, you know, when it comes down to those sort of top 5 guys, you look at like Rumble and DC and, you know, don't even, you know, bring up John Jones. I mean, all these guys, I think, are, you know, a cut above Ryan Bader. That being said, I mean, I definitely agree with what you said, that he does have a chance to win this fight. I do think that, you know, if you can weather that storm and sort of, you know, tire Anthony Johnson out, because we know that, you know, Rumble kind of, he throws those bombs and he puts so much into it, that if you can find a way to get out of the way of those initial shots for that first round and maybe that second round, there is a chance that you could tire him out and maybe, you know, put him against the fence and put him down to the ground if he sort of, you know, is having some cardio issues. I think that's probably the most feasible way for Bader to win the fight. But if he, you know, puts himself in a firefight with Anthony Johnson, I don't think it's going to end well.
Before we leave this card, a quick tour through the prelims. What's one fight for you that really jumps out as a bout that people tuning in on Saturday need to check out, whether it's the Fight Pass prelims or the Fox Sports 1, I believe TSN 4 out here on the West Coast, that people should really tune in to see, whether it's super competitive fight or young guy coming up that people need to pay attention to?
Yeah, to me, you know, whenever Olivier Aubin-Mercier, he fights, I'm interested. You know, the Tough Nation sort of standout from Quebec. You know, he's been doing very well in the UFC lately. I mean, he had that split decision loss to Chad Lapree in that Tough Nations finale. But since then, he's looked really good. You know, submission victories over Jake Lindsay and David Michaud. And then he followed that up with a victory over Tony Sims last August in Saskatchewan, which you were at. You know, I think he's one of those guys who is also, you know, very young and continuing to develop. And I'm excited to see what he can do against, you know, a high level Brazilian jiu-jitsu specialist like, you know, Carlos Diego Ferreira. It'll be interesting, you know, to see if he can put it together and sort of continue this, you know, upward trajectory that he's had.
Yeah, one of the things I like about Ollie, just, I mean, as a fighter, I think he has potential, but one of the things I like about where he's at career-wise and just mentally in regards to his career is that he's always said and continues to say going into this fight, I want that slow progression. I don't want to jump into this too far, too fast. I want to take my time. I want to go step by step because I know I'm not there yet. I know that I need to. He said to me when we spoke last week that he feels like he's at 50% of his potential, which you see that he's got 3 straight wins in the UFC, 2 of them finishes. If that's 50%, it's very interesting to see what he can be and how good he'll be at 100%. I like that pick. I think it's a great fight. Obviously, we have another Canadian kicking off the show, Kelowna boy Matt Dwyer taking on the latest looking for a fight signee, Randy Brown. The other fight I'm really interested in and the other guy that I'm looking forward to checking out again is Dustin Ortiz, who I think is a veteran grinder in the flyweight division, that the losses that he's had have been against really good competition. Even if you go back to his pre-UFC days, losing to Ian McCall, at Tachi Palace, takes on Wilson Hayes here in a fight that, you know, the way DJ has gone through everybody in this division, Dustin Ortiz gets a second and a third consecutive victory. He can be in position, and I don't necessarily think he's going to go out there and beat DJ, because I don't think anybody in the division realistically is going to beat DJ. But he's a tough out. He's a guy, you know, I was at his fight in Austin, Texas against Joe Benavidez, and Joe was lighting him up and landing and landing and landing, and Dustin Ortiz would not go away. He would just continue to stand in there. I think that's a thing we don't talk about enough with some of these guys. We sort of look at that they're not in the top five and they're not flashy, and we discount them. And I think Dustin Ortiz goes out this weekend and has another great performance and really sort of cements himself as somebody that's in that mix in the flyweight division.
Absolutely. I agree with that. And another fight that I'm sort of curious in seeing, is the return of Tarek Safadine against, Jake Ellenberger. I mean, this will be Safadine's first fight since UFC Halifax in October 2014 when he fought Rory McDonald. And, you know, I think he's a guy that, was doing a lot of, great things in Strikeforce and, has only had two fights in the UFC so far. So putting him against another vet like Jake Ellenberger, that's an interesting fight to me as well.
And Jake Ellenberger coming out trying to sort of redeem Edmund Tarverdian. Obviously, Travis Brown got a win last 2 weeks ago against Matt Mitrione, but that was kind of janky with the eye pokes. Jake Ellenberger, a former top 10, top 5 guy in the welterweight division that just has not looked very good over his last four fights. So it'll be interesting to see if he can turn it around. But we'll leave this fight card. We'll swing into our championship rounds. Take a look at the fight card that we've mentioned and alluded to a couple of times already. UFC 196 next weekend in Las Vegas. Formerly a pay-per-view, announced today on Tuesday that it will instead be on Fox Sports 1. Very good question posed by a friend of the podcast, Nick Baldwin, earlier today on Twitter. We don't know for sure if TSN is going to cover this. As other friend of the podcast, Brocky Balboa, replied, they may very well have a block of SportsCenter queued up that they need to just keep running over and over and over. But obviously, we lost the heavyweight main event. Cain Velasquez yet again comes down with an injury. I say yet again, not as a knock on Cain, just as an unfortunate reality and situation that continues to follow him around. Stipe Miocic gets tagged in. Fabricio Werdum then gets up this morning and says, you know what, my back's feeling a little bit out. And if Cain was around, I would fight him. But because it's a change and he's not ready, I think I'm just going to bow out too. So before we get to the fight card that we have remaining, which is a very good fight card for a televised show, what are your thoughts on the whole main event situation? Let's start with Cain, work to Werdum, and then just the division as a whole right now, because it feels like it's just suddenly tumbled into chaos.
Yeah, it's a bit of a messy situation, to say the least. And it's, as you said, it's super unfortunate to see, Cain go down with yet another injury. I mean, this is something that's happened a few times now in his career. And I think that, it's starting to become sort of a pattern and a trend in an unfortunate way. It's tough to see a guy with, so much, talent and such a great heavyweight as Cain, kind of be on the sideline for, these long periods of time, and who knows how long he'll be out for now. I have no idea, but it is tough to sort of have him on the shelf for any period of time, because he is, I think still in my eyes, one of the more popular heavyweights, I think, if not the most popular heavyweight in the division. People obviously, know that Werdum is now the champion, but in a lot of ways, they need to see that rematch to sort of, see if Cain would be different at sea level, obviously. So it is tough to see Cain go out with another injury. And I really do wish him a speedy recovery and hope he can get back, to fighting form soon. But at the same time, the show must go on.
It's E. Spencer Kite and Patrick Spiklinski on the Keyboard Kimura podcast on Province Sports Radio. talking about UFC 196, the heavyweight championship fight that is not happening. I don't begrudge Fabricio Werdum at all for pulling out of this fight. I know obviously there have been people on social media saying a bunch of stuff, calling, you know, saying he's ducking Stipe Miocic, getting mad that he's not fighting, things like that. These are also the same people that would absolutely complain about paying $60 for a, you know, 2 weeks notice title fight. I think it's the right thing for him to do, and I honestly wish more guys in his position would do it. There is a lot at stake. He has worked his entire career to get to this point and prepared for a guy in Cain Velasquez who, yes, has some similarities to Stipe Miocic. They're both conditioned guys. They're both, you know, strong wrestling bases. They're both heavy-handed strikers. But game plan-wise, it's just such a change, and even just mentally, it's such a shift to be geared up for fighting one guy to then be told, hey, you're going to fight this other dude who's equally dangerous, that I don't have any problem with him saying, you know what, let's press pause on this. Let's figure it out and see what happens in a couple of months whenever you want to run this back, whether it's against Cain, whether it's against Stipe. My guess is it's going to be Miocic whenever this does come back together. But I don't have a problem with what Werdum is doing here. Do you?
No, I absolutely agree with you 100% on this. He's the champion. It's his right, and I do agree with you again when you say that I think more guys should be doing this. There is so much at stake, like you said, for Werdum. He's, you know, he's 38 years old. He's won this championship, a very, very, you know, tough fight that, you know, people were saying he had absolutely no chance to, you know, beat Cain. A lot of people counting him out, and then he wins the fight. And now to put him in a position where, you know, he would have to switch opponents on short notice, you know, just so he can show up, I think that it's not fair to expect that of him. And I think that he should be able to say no to that fight and have it on his terms, more so, because he is the champion. He's earned that right. And I think that if he went out there against a guy like Stipe, as you said, you know, Stipe is a little bit similar to Cain in some ways, but it's a different guy. It's a different matchup. And to prepare for something like that, it takes a lot of, you know, mental adjusting. And, you know, if he's already sort of having, you know, maybe some injury issues or whatever it was, you know, before that, then maybe this is all the more reason to, like you said, press pause and sort of reassess things and give it a few months to, you know, cool down. We'll see what happens with Cain. Whether or not he fights again soon, we'll see if they get that rematch. And if not, then Stipe's the next guy, and he'll have the time to prepare for him, as, you know, he rightfully should, as the champion. And for a guy as dangerous as Stipe, you don't want to fight him on, you know, whatever, 2 weeks' notice.
So with the UFC unable to find a suitable main event to station atop this pay-per-view, they decided to move forward with the fight card as is, move it to television, with the main event being a welterweight matchup between Johnny Hendricks and Stephen Wonderboy Thompson. One of the funny things to me is that everybody sort of, the reaction when that was announced, everybody agreed universally that it was the right call. I echo that. I think there's no way the UFC should have moved forward with this as a pay-per-view unless they were able to get something big. The funny thing to me is that the secondary sort of sentiment is, and this is such a great card on TV, but so many people were ripping it when it was maybe going to be the pay-per-view. I get that it's not worth $60 if this was what they tried to give you originally, but there seems to be no understanding of, or no recognition of, but we lost the most important fight. Like, I don't think you could really say this is such a horrible fight card. People saying, oh, UFC, this should show you, never make pay-per-views that are built around one fight. Johnny Hendricks is a former welterweight champion. Joe Benavidez and Zach Makov. I mean, Joseph Benavidez is the number two fighter in the flyweight division behind Demetrius Johnson. Zach Makovsky is a tough guy. These are okay fights to me as the rest of a main card for a pay-per-view if you have that title fight there. So to just really rip into it feels like a disservice to these guys that are now on what people are calling a great FS1 show.
Absolutely no, and I agree with that as well. I mean, I had no problem with this being a pay-per-view, you know, main card. Like you said, Joe Benavidez, Zach Mikowski, that's a great fight. Then you get, you know, if you had Johnny Hendricks and Wonder Boy in that co-main event slot, that's another great fight. And I always love to see Ovince St. Preux fight. So the main card, I had no problems with at all. You know, being, you know, someone who covers the sport, I would have had it anyways. But I do think it's a very, very good pay-per-view card as is, and I don't think that people, you know, should be so quick to, you know, discredit, you know, all these guys and say, well, you know, oh, this definitely should have been a free card and all that. I think that's kind of nonsense, but I do think that overall it was the right call with sort of that loss of the main event. But I think, you know, I look at as you know, I look at it as, you know, this sort of being a treat. You know, we really are going to get a good card for free, and I think that, you know, fans should be appreciative of that. It's going to be a really, really good card. It's a deep card. There's a lot of good fights on here that are all going to be for free now, and I think that it's a great thing, and it'll hopefully draw some eyes.
Which, of course, just means that you and I are shills that are always going to tell people to just buy UFC shows and watch all of them because we are in the UFC's pocket, and that's what we do. Looking at this main event, Johnny Hendricks, obviously, in a very precarious position coming off that weight-cutting debacle at UFC 192, where the day before the fight, weight cut goes haywire. He goes to the hospital with kidney stones, gets pulled out. To go from, you know, back-to-back title fights with Robbie Lawler, both close fights, wins the first, loses the second in a close, questionable decision. Goes out, gets a strong victory against Matt Brown. Looks like he's in a position where you beat Tyron Woodley, you're right back in the mix. To be where he's at now, do you think in any way he might be rattled? He might be, you know, this is maybe kind of a trap fight for him in taking on a guy that's outside of the top 10 in Stephen Thompson, but is dangerous? Or do you expect this to be kind of a grand comeback for Big Rig?
I definitely do think it's a dangerous fight for him, especially, you know, with all the weight cut issues that we've seen recently, with Johnny Hendricks. He was supposed to fight Tyron Woodley. Obviously, that never happened, you know, like you said, and now he's in kind of a tough spot because a win over Stephen Thompson, you know, a lot of people are going to say, well, you know, he should have beat him, but at the same time, you know, Wonder Boy is on a very impressive run, and he's a, you know, a cardio, you know, machine, and he puts in a lot of effort into his, you know, technique, which is very unique and very hard to deal with for some guys. And this could be a very high risk kind of fight for him. I don't see a lot of, you know, upside for him, you know, to win this fight unless he wins it in impressive fashion and goes out there and maybe, you know, knocks Wonder Boy out. Other than that, if he, you know, wins it in sort of a grueling, you know, decision, I don't think it does much for him as much as it would do for, you know, Wonder Boy to win this fight. You know, you beat Johnny Hendricks and you're suddenly in that top five conversation.
Yeah, I was going to say the one thing that may really sort of vault Johnny Hendricks back into that upper tier conversation is if he comes out and scores one of those John Fitch, Martin Campman left hand of doom in, you know, 15 seconds, just lays Stephen Thompson out, whose only loss in the UFC is to Matt Brown, that he took on short notice in his second fight, going from, you know, UFC debut against Dan Stichen, where he looked great, to jumping in with Matt Brown, who was very early in his super comeback that carried him into the top five. So I agree with you. Very tough fight. Wonder Boy is a weird stylistic matchup because he's so good at maintaining range. He has those kicks. It'd be interesting to see if Johnny Hendricks wants to stand and swing with him or if he wants to go to his wrestling. I don't think we're going to have issues in terms of the weight cut. He's been working with Luis Giordano throughout this camp. talked to him a week ago. He was at, I believe, 180 when I spoke to him, which is crazy given that it was, you know, 2 weeks out. So that's a very positive sign. Hopefully all goes well and we don't have any more issues, because honestly, I don't think John Hendricks could survive in the UFC if things go haywire before he gets on the scale.
Yeah, absolutely.
Don't want to go through all of the fights on this main card because we're running a little long already, but just similar to what we did with the last fight card, what's one or two fights that really jump out for you that people should be paying attention to on this former pay-per-view that is now, as you said, available completely on television from start to finish?
I think that the Justin Scoggins Ray Bourque fight is definitely an interesting one. You know, we've seen sort of, you know, this guy, Ray Bourque, you know, have a nice little run, you know, three wins in his last three fights. His only loss in the UFC came to, you know, a very tough, like you said, Dustin Ortiz in a split decision. He's looked very good, you know, two performances of the night. And he's come out there and performed really well. You know, his submission game is relentless. And I think, you know, Justin Scoggins is one of those guys that, you know, there were high expectations. He kind of had a little setback in a couple losses. He had to, you know, Dustin Ortiz and then to John Moraga, but he came back strong against Josh Sampo at UFC 187. So I'm really interested, you know, to see what happens. Scoggins and Bourque is a really interesting flyweight matchup, in my opinion.
Couple of things for me. I 100% agree with you. I'm absolutely confused as to why that fight is the second fight in on Fight Pass. No disrespect to Mike Pyle, who still has the best mullet in the game, and Sean Spencer, who has the best last name in the UFC. But that fight should not be on Fox Sports 1 when you've got two young, up-and-coming flyweights in a division where you need to build guys, where you need to get some of these guys exposure, where we talked about last segment, DJ is running through everybody. Ray Bourque gets another victory. He's in the top 10. He's starting to face some of these bigger names. Showcase them. Get them on even just the televised prelims. It's the way to go to me. Couple fights for me that I'm looking forward to that I think people should be paying attention to. One, I have to give the shout out to the Canadian Misha Serkinov taking on Alex Nicholson. Light heavyweight is so void of young, fresh talent that I think there is an opportunity for Misha to make some waves. He got a first round submission win in his debut. He is a very talented grappler. He also looks the part of a contender. He is a massive man. The other fight for me, and you know, people may laugh, may chuckle, but I talked about it on one of the last shows we did of 2015. The fight I'm most looking forward to this year is CM Punk's debut. We may find out who he's fighting next Saturday, because Mickey Gall on the looking for a fight, wins his fight, stands there in the cage and says, Dana White, I don't know if CM Punk has an opponent yet, but I'm game. Dana White says, I like this kid's moxie, goes back, offers him a fight. So he's taking on 0-0, making his professional debut in the UFC, which is kind of crazy. Mike Jackson, who is a MMA community sort of journalist down in Houston. And basically the stipulation is, if Mickey Gall wins this fight, he's facing CM Punk. Like, this dude has a chance to change his life next Saturday. So I think people should definitely be tuning in for that one.
That is an absolute contender fight. You get the chance to fight CM Punk. That's a golden ticker right there. I think, you know, Mickey Gall, I think he's going to be putting in, you know, his best effort for this, because if he wins, oh boy, like you said, his life's going to change.
Well, and this is the way to do it. Like, in all seriousness, I love the way that they're approaching this. Like, you have him on the show. He gets a little bit of a rub from that. You put him on this pay-per-view, now on television. Yes, the fight is on Fight Pass. But as I've said on the blog and as we've said on here, people, if you're a fight fan, you need to have Fight Pass. It's $10 a month. I think you can get the first couple months free. You get a deal if you buy it over the course of a year. So just go out and get it. It's worth your while. They're continuing to do important fights on Fight Pass for every card. Just go and buy it. There I go shilling for the UFC again. But I think it's the right way to do it. You give this guy an opportunity to get a little momentum. If he goes out and gets this victory, then there's a little bit of a story to it instead of it just being, oh, look at CM Punk. So I wish Mickey all the best. Not that I have any ill will towards Mike Jackson, but I just think it's a chance to really build what was already going to be an interesting fight into an even more interesting fight. Sure. So before we take off, well, we don't have a fight of the week this week just because we've already covered this weekend's card. We've already looked at next weekend's event as well. But we couldn't leave, we couldn't end the show without touching on the press conference from last week. Episode, I think it's like 47 of the Conor McGregor show, I would like to call it. What were your main takeaways from the UFC 197? I don't think it was even the on sale press conference. I don't think tickets were on sale yet. I think it was just a launch press conference. What was the biggest takeaways for you?
Well, I mean, besides that, beautiful, beautiful El Chapo themed shirt that Conor McGregor was wearing.
That shirt was the worst.
It was interesting. The whole press conference, I think the biggest takeaway was, sort of seeing Conor just run the show. He came in late. He came in and sort of, made a joke with the media, that he doesn't wear watches to check the time. And he came in there, sat down like, he ran the show. Like, this was Conor McGregor Promotions featuring Dana White and Rafael dos Anjos. So that was sort of the biggest thing that I saw. He just came in there and acted like he ran the show. Every time, RDA tried to say something, Conor would just cut him off and, say something, to some very Conor-esque and out there. And it was just a very interesting conference in terms of seeing sort of Conor come in there and just look like, he was in charge of this whole press conference. Like, everyone was there to see him. Granted, probably most people were there to see him, but he just did a total takeover of that entire press conference.
It is hilarious to me how much he has become, and we talked about it earlier on an earlier episode of this podcast, that he has sort of become, and it feels like we're starting to see that tension between Conor and the UFC. Like, it feels to me like he turned up late just to show that he can turn up late and make a quip about, as you said, not wearing watches to tell time, and just sort of show the UFC that you've got to wait for me. I'm the main attraction. I'm the reason people are here. So we're going to do this when I want to turn up. I think it's very interesting that there was no championship belt in front of him, that there isn't a title slung over his shoulder on the poster, not just because I think it's interesting, the dynamic of Conor going off and saying that it was Bush League and people have been, the marketing department and the promotions department is not doing their job in that regard. But I think it's the UFC dropping the ball by not promoting this as the historic matchup it is. It's been 6 years since we've had two champions face each other. And I remember that poster. BJ Penn had the lightweight belt over his shoulder, even though it wasn't on the line. But I think that's part of the sort of power struggle and dynamic struggle that we're seeing right now. So it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out going forward. I will say that I felt bad for Holly Holm and Miesha Tate. It's different than UFC 189, where Robbie Lawler and Rory McDonald are two dudes that are absolutely content to just play the cut and not say a word ever and let Conor run the show. Holly Holm and Miesha Tate, this is an important fight. Holly's coming off that massive win over Ronda Rousey. She needs some shine. She needs some opportunity to say some things. She needs some opportunity to be in the spotlight. Yes, she fielded a couple of questions, but it felt like, and Conor even say it, I wanted Holly on this card. She has Irish blood. I'm happy to have her on here. And, almost like he's granting her the opportunity. I hope that doesn't stay that way over the next month as we promote this fight, as we get towards UFC 197. I hope Holly Holm is able to, and Miesha Tate for that matter, are able to branch off a little. And it's not always those four fighters together at press events. Because if that's the case, Conor McGregor, as he is wont to do, is going to swallow up all of the attention and nobody is going to be talking about what is a pretty important fight in the women's bantamweight division.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's that that's just the way, you know, things are, you know, going to go from now on. Whenever you have Conor McGregor in a room with a microphone, with people around, he is going to just take it over completely. And that is what we saw at that UFC, you know, 197 press conference. It is unfortunate, like you said. I mean, you know, Holly is coming off, you know, a massive, massive upset over Ronda Rousey and such a huge fight for her. And now coming into a fight with Miesha Tate, it would be great to, you know, have heard a little more from her. But it, you know, it won't happen with Conor in the room. So that's just one of those things that he's a guy who loves the attention. He loves to be in there. He loves to talk. He loves the cameras pointed at him. And if you have a microphone, you know, in front of this guy, he will take advantage of that every single time.
Yeah, there are no wasted opportunities to speak or, you know, command attention, as you said. But that's going to do it for us. I appreciate you staying up and doing this with me, jumping in on short notice as sort of Chappy is caught up in the chaos. I hope that all sorts out at Post Media and the province very soon so we can know what's going on with everybody, not just, you know, selfishly for ourselves, but just the company as a whole taking those next step forwards. But before I jump out of here and let you go, let people know what's coming down the pipe. Let people know where they can follow your thoughts and jabs at me as you continue to move ahead of me in the Punch Drunk Predictions contest on social media.
Well, absolutely. You know, as always, we got some Punch Drunk Predictions coming up for this week. That should be coming out, I believe, on Friday. Continue to see, you know, my evolution as a Punch Drunk Prediction specialist. You know, I'm working with a great camp now, and we're getting some techniques down and just trying to, you know, develop the game.
Well done. I really appreciate that. I'm looking forward to hopefully reversing this losing streak that I'm going on. But that's it for me, guys. As always, you can follow me on Twitter at Spencer Kite. He is at Patrick Swiklinski, Swiklinski. It is a mouthful. One day he may change it. Who knows? We'll see. As always, guys, we really appreciate you tuning in to the Keyboard Kimura podcast here at Province Sports Radio. Jump on iTunes, jump on Stitcher, jump on SoundCloud. Subscribe, leave comments, give us a rating. We greatly appreciate it. And as always, tune in next week. But until then, enjoy the fights.
You've been listening to Keyboard Kimura, the official mixed martial arts podcast of the province. Read the Keyboard Kimura blog on theprovince.com, follow them on Twitter at Keyboard Kimura, or visit them on Facebook at facebook.com/Keyboard Kimura.